So, Greek mythology has the king Minos of Crete asked Poseidon. Poseidon is the god of the sea and earthquakes and, believe it or not, horses. I don't know what the connection is there. But anyway, he asked Poseidon for a white bull, and Poseidon gave it to him to offer as a sacrifice. But Minos reneges on his commitment to sacrifice the bull to Poseidon. So Poseidon is honked off at this, and he causes Minos's wife to fall in love with a bull. Her name is Queen Pasiphae. And guess what? I'm not sure how the biology works on this, but a minotaur is born. She gives birth to a minotaur. It's got a man's body and the head of a bull. Well, Minos, of course, is a little embarrassed by this, and he imprisons this minotaur in the labyrinth. Okay. Well, eventually the kingdom of Crete defeats the kingdom of Athens, or the nation of Athens, whatever it would have been, nation, I suppose. And Athens is forced to send tributes, much like if you've seen the Hunger Games, a similar sort of a deal, for sacrifice to be eaten by the Minotaur in the labyrinth, in the center labyrinth. Well, Minos's daughter, whose name is Ariadne, falls in love with Theseus of Athens, so he volunteers to be a tribute. Well, she gives him a red thread for him to go into the labyrinth and find his way out of the labyrinth. So that he could go in and confront and defeat the Minotaur. And in fact, he does. Slays the Minotaur, rescues the captives because there are other tributes, leaves the labyrinth, and he just gets on with life. I'm not sure what happens after that, but he comes out here in Ariadne get together. I'm not sure. Anyway, doesn't matter. But the key takeaway from this is that the Minotaur is used throughout Greek mythology and also after that to represent the worst of human nature, our immoral human attributes, buried secrets, repressed fears, destructive passions that must be confronted. Okay. So I'm going to talk about four short biographies, but before I do that, I'm going to talk about some in things that influence us as to who we are and how we got here. And I'm just going to talk briefly about this. This is not a science presentation, but our ethnicity determines how we interact with the world and how the world interacts with us. We share cultural values, history, language. All those are part of our ethnicity. My kids are from Latin America. They're ethnically different from most of us in this room. Okay? And then we have genetics. This is essentially your DNA, your foundational traits that predispose you, make you receptive, not receptive to certain engagements, interactions that you have with your environment. There's a lot of course study in genetic research you can get into. I'm not going to that much. So your genetics can determine your aversion to risk. How much risk are you willing to take? How sensitive are you to threats that appear in your environment? What are your tolerance for novelty? Do you like to try new things? Do you not like to try new things so much? What are your moral boundaries, your conscientiousness, how aware you are of your surroundings, your agreeableness, etc.? All these can be determined or have some connection to your genetics, your DNA. And there's a source of study these days called epigenetics. And this is the study of how your DNA can be influenced by your parents and your ancestors' experiences in life. And there have been studies done of Holocaust survivors, and of course, they were subject to tremendous trauma while incarcerated in concentration camps. And studies have shown that the offspring of these concentration camp survivors have similar PTSD responses because this idea of epigenetics, they're like switches that help determine how receptive your genes are to making things happen or how you interact, can be passed down from generation to generation. Your life experiences can modify your children's body chemistry. Very early thinking on that, but there's some science that's going on around this. And so you've heard about people who may be predisposed to diabetic or cancer because of their genetics. So they're looking and saying, well, are there ways to predict if somebody's going to be affected by PTSD in future generations? Anyway, very early science. So let's talk about four biographies. So here's Maya. Maya is born in Detroit to a drug dealer and a mother who is a prostitute and abetting crimes in Detroit. So her father's killed in a drug deal in Detroit. Her mom is serving 15 to 20 for prostitution and abetting crime. So she's growing up in family turmoil. She was essentially taken in by her grandmother, who was a solid member of the AME, that's the African Methodist Episcopal Church, primarily black church. By the way, it's founded in 1816, so it's got roots that are kind of concurrent with our own, right? Wouldn't you say that? Around the same early 1800s. So she was raised in a very boisterous AME church environment in Detroit, and the church is very culturally intertwined with the community in black communities. She was spurred to attend trade school in Detroit, and in fact went to trade school to become a solar energy technician, and because of the influence of her grandmother, because of the church had a scholarship fund, and because the state of Michigan has grants to send people to trade schools. So, and she took a job eventually outside of her comfort zone and now living in Iowa as a solar technician for a solar installation company in Iowa. She's attending essentially a white church there. There's no AME churches in this town where she lives. She's attending a white church where she is influenced and part of that fellowship, worshiping with them. She still has the reflex to lift her hands in praise during singing, and some of the people in the congregation are following that with her. Not all, but they're getting there. She's politically liberal. She joined the NAACP along with her grandmother, and she's studying for ordination to go back to Detroit and become a pastor, minister in the AME church, because she wants to give back to that church that did so much informing her, shaping her being, her Christianity, if you will. Then we have Jim. Jim was born in 1939, California. He, of course, much like Maya, has his own unique genetic predispositions. He's ethnically Japanese, but in 1942, a few months after what happened in December of 1941, Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. So, of course, there's this hue and cry against anybody who is of Japanese ancestry. In executive order, I think it was 9066, you can look it up, president at the time, FDR, authorized the military to build internment camps, mostly in the West. Actually, it classified certain people as being enemies. The Japanese were the most common to be incarcerated, although it did extend to other groups, the Germans and Italians as well, but primarily the Japanese. So Jim, at the age of 3 years old, found himself in a camp in Tule Lake, California. He encountered, of course, racial hostility. He's in prison during World War II, and he didn't really have any religious foundation, Christian or anything. But in this camp in Tule Lake, there was cooperation between Buddhist groups and Christian groups, primarily Episcopal, that helped provide spiritual nourishment for the people who were in the camp. And also they were helped by Christian groups who were outside of the camp that lived in the area that brought food, shelter, clothing, and all that kind of stuff. Eventually came out in 1946. The camp didn't close until well after the war ended, until the truce had been signed, but they were in there till 1946. Came out, and of course still was in a highly suspicious environment, because if you know anything about how the Japanese treated American prisoners in World War II, really, really, really bad. So there was this also bad blood stuff going on. He but broke through the bounds of that. He went to school in Texas, received a doctorate in chemistry, actually taught chemistry at a Texas university, then received a law degree from some school in Chicago. I'm not sure what it was. And he eventually had these stops throughout the country that influences Christianity. Sometime during this time, he became a Christian, and he moved to the East Coast, where he became a lawyer, a corporate environmental and compliance lawyer for a huge multinational corporation. And during this time, his spiritual faith grew to the point where he became an elder in the church that he became part of at that point. Okay, so that's Jim. This is Boutros. Boutros is born on the West Bank in Palestine. He has a unique genetic disposition. He's ethnically Palestinian, Semitic, frankly. He grew up in an Eastern Orthodox tradition, which has its rituals and liturgies and stuff like that. But because of ongoing conflict in the West Bank, he became separated from his family, became orphaned from his family, but was rescued by an American Christian organization that provides relief efforts in the Middle East, and was relocated back to the southern United States. He lost his family. He, of course, experienced a lot of conflict in the area where he had grown up. He moved back here, and there were language, cultural barriers. There's no Orthodox Church, Eastern Orthodox Church, in the area where he was born or where he relocated to. But he became immersed in the church that essentially adopted him. They provided him a shelter, helped to find work, and he became a member of that church community. Eventually he grew up, and he now works for a non-government organization that tries to foster foster cooperative relationships between his church in the south of the U.S. and the Orthodox Church back in the West Bank. And when he's in the south, he worships with his congregation. When he's in the West Bank, he worships with his Palestinian brethren who are part of this Orthodox Church. And it's difficult for him to serve there because of the hostile political climate. See, a lot of the folks that are in the Orthodox Church in the West Bank and that part of the world are suspicious of American fundamentalist groups, because those typically side with Israel, and those are typically at war with these folks here. So it's a difficult environment. I'm not making a political statement, just saying what the reality is that there are people that are, it's a difficult situation because to cooperate between the Orthodox group, fundamentalist groups, just because of a political environment. Anyway, that is also shaping his approach to Christianity. And last, we have Thomas. Thomas has his unique genetic predisposition and his ethnicity. Looks like a lot of us in this room, frankly. He grew up in a loving, stable family. Christian generosity was modeled in his home. His father was a World War II veteran, and after the war, founded a company and began a company, became highly successful. Thomas grew up during Vietnam in the 60s, and at that time, he heard in his home, "My country, right or wrong," which was, those of you of a certain age will understand, that the country came first. Whatever that we're doing in Vietnam, that's the way it is. And Thomas grew up, and he grew up in that environment, although it was a loving, stable home life. He'd went away to get a college education, and so he could come back and take the reins of his father's business. While he was in college, he saw God working through the people that he associated with at the college community church, the college congregation. Those were people that came from a whole variety of Christian backgrounds, and saw God working through the efforts of those individuals and others that they were associated with. When he came back, he still remained committed to his home church. He's politically conservative, but he separates and generates, contributes his income to other organizations other than just through the church, which is what his father had done. So anyway, this is Thomas. So let's go back to Colossae, which is what Abby read, Colossians. So Colossae is here. You can see this red arrow. I hope you can see this red arrow up here. Come on. Anyway, the red arrow. So, you know, Colossae is sort of like Corinth light. We hear about Corinth being diverse because of its crossroads in the ancient world in Greece. Well, Colossae had a similar sort of composition. It's the area here was previously a Roman route that went through here, and it was a trade route. They were on the route, but it changed over time. They had a thriving trade, but it changed because the Romans changed how they did business around the world, and they kind of bypassed this, and so the area is in kind of an economic decline. They were famous for red wool. You see the background on these slides, it's kind of got this red, it's hard to see up there, this red wool, but they were famous for their red wool that came from this part of the world. There are a lot of sheep there. Apparently the environment was able to raise sheep there really good, I guess. I don't know. So they were famous for their red wool. This is a melting pot, much like Corinth, of Phrygians. These are folks that came from other places in Asia Minor and parts of Europe, Greeks and Jews and others that helped create the cultural environment for this. And there were religious practices different, of course, because, as I said, it was a merger of various trade routes and other influences. So religious practices, pagan, Jewish folk, Christian influences from the surrounding towns. You may recognize some of these from Paul's writings and the writings of John and Revelation. So their genetics, much like our four biographies, genetics, ethnicity, family life, education, occupation, social status, etc., all influenced the people that Paul was writing to in the book of Colossians. They're not all the same, much like we're not all the same, because of these influences. Plus, in AD 60 approximately, there's an earthquake that comes through this region, knocks these towns down, the three particular, which was Colossae, Hierapolis, and Laodicea, I believe. They were knocked flat. So sometime during this, don't know, scholars are like not quite sure as to when this earthquake happened, these earthquakes happened vis-a-vis Paul's writing to them. But imagine there's still Roman, Greek influences here. Earthquakes, must be the gods. Like, I mean, surely there was some of that attitude that were part of influences on the population of Colossae, and so therefore on the church that Paul wrote to. So if you read the first part of Colossians, it talks about some of the issues that were pressing on them that Paul addressed in his letter. There's this blending of Christianity with other philosophies. Can't be having that. They had a diminished view of Christ. They didn't necessarily view him, some did not view him as being God incarnate. He was lesser. There was Jewish legalism. There were Jews that are part of this, and the Jews, of course, some sects of Jews are highly legalistic. Asceticism, denying your body comfort in order to whip it into submission, essentially. And also they had angel worship. So all of these things were pressures on the church that Paul would have, I gotta move over here, I guess. Paul would have addressed, he did address in his letter. So Colossians 3. So we've got our little view of the Minotaur up here, right? And what did the Minotaur represent? The bad part of human nature, essentially. So I've got my little Minotaur up here because Paul says these are earthly things that promote disunity and need to be what? Put to death. There's a whole list of them here. Not going to read them again. Abby read them. These are things that promote disunity and need to be put to death. But then he goes on to say, in addition to these things that are part of your human nature, what are you guys doing with all these labels? Why are you labeling somebody as a Gentile, as a Jew, circumcised, non-circumcised? These are things that are labels that also promote disunity. I wonder if Paul were to write to this church here, what labels he might throw on us that is keeping us from being unified. He says, instead, kind of like, looks like baby Yoda, maybe. Don't really mean that. What does he say instead? He says, be clothed with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, forgiveness, above all, love, these things that enable unity, which, I'm going to jump over since I talked about Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13, okay? We all know this famous chapter of love, which gives characteristics of love that we are compelled to embody in our Christian existence. And finally, back to Colossians, binds them all together. Binds them together in perfect unity or perfect harmony. Okay. So, unity takeaways from chapter 3. Since then you've been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. Not on these things that were to put to death, not on labels that identify us in the outside world. Those are things, earthly things. Put to death. So this is interesting. The Greek word here, I'd say I got it close to it. It's, what is it? Nekrosate. Okay. To make dead, not to let die off. To make dead. The Greek word commands it to deprive of power, an intentional, deliberate, and violent cessation of life was one translation I saw this. So what is this? Back to the labyrinth, Theseus slays. He doesn't like to sit down and play cards with them, have a cup of coffee. No. He goes in, slays, puts to death this. Put on a new self, new, being renewed. We'll talk about that in a second. Being renewed in knowledge, the image of its creator. It's a continuous process along the path. Here, there is no Jew, or Gentile Jew, circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian. By the Scythians, barbarians, Scythians. Barbarians are bad. Scythians made barbarians look like Girl Scouts, okay? They were considered to be like the worst of the worst. But Christ is all and in all. In the church, there should be no human differences or labels. We all are different. Don't misunderstand me. There should be no disunity based on our differences. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. So bind, I just highlighted this word bind. Bind. This word bind is the same word that's used to describe how the body is held together by ligaments. How fascinating is that? I find it to be fascinating. Body's held together by ligaments. Other parts of Paul's writing, he talks about as being different parts of the body held together with love. All right. Living Bible, just like things. So the white, this is the Living Bible. So the white is the actual scripture. The yellow is sort of my interpretation, sort of. So you're living a brand new kind of life that is continually learning. We're all journeying through the labyrinth, by the way, to get to the center. We're on this journey. More and more of what is right, that is to slay the Minotaur and put on, and be more and more clothed in Christ, who created this new life within you. In this new life, one's nationality, race, or education, or social position, or political persuasion, or job, or wealth, or language, or any number of other variables that brand us as anything but unique children of God is unimportant. Such things mean nothing. Whether a person has Christ is what matters, and he is equally available to all. Okay. All right. So back to our little labyrinth here. notice that I highlight these two things. So on the far right side, underneath Maya's picture, that's the entrance to the labyrinth. On the left side, toward the center, that's the exit into the center. But guess what? You can't get there directly. Those lines do not connect. You have to go all the way around. It starts to go center and then it comes down around this way and around that. And my little pointer thing is not working. But you can't get there from here. It's a long journey, folks. Long. And so I'm going to flip this a little bit and say, not only are we headed toward the center of this labyrinth in order to slay the Minotaur, we're also headed through the labyrinth to put on the clothes of Christ. They go together. All right, now, I have a confession to make. The four stories that I told you, one of them is true. The other three I made up, but are based on real situations. There are organizations that work in the Middle East to foster peace between the Orthodox community and American communities that try to help support them, okay? There are trade school programs in Detroit that will train you to be a solar engineer. The AME Church is highly established in black communities around the country. There are people who have been incarcerated in American POW camps in the Western United States. There are people that went to colleges and universities that got a diverse view of the world and Christianity. So anybody want to guess? And I know a couple of you know who the real one is. Anybody want to guess who the real one is? All right, how many say Maya, the black girl? One over here. Okay, one in the back. Okay. How many say Jim, the Japanese concentration camp guy? A couple in the back. Okay. How many say Boutros, who is the Palestinian who's back and forth? No. How many say Thomas, the white person? Wow, a lot of people are not sure, not voting at all. Must be working well. Anyway, the truth is that Jim Takamoto is a real person, who was a real person. He died about a year ago. This is his record in the National Archives of him being incarcerated at the Tule Lake camp in Northern California during World War II. On here, it's hard to read, but it says that he's from California. His parents, by the way, were both American citizens. He was an American citizen. Much of the population that found themselves in these camps were American citizens. Jim, just to complete his story, it's all here. This is it, by the way. It was considered to be the most notorious of all the World War II internment camps because it had 19,000 inmates at its peak. It was overcrowded. There were protests, kind of violence, things like that. The government militarized the camp, et cetera, et cetera. It was a nasty, miserable, horrible, awful, terrible place. And it was operational, like I said, until March of 46 when Jim's records show that he was released. Anyway, Jim was released. He did all that stuff I told you about. He got his degree. He became a lawyer for Exxon, environmental lawyer during the, by the way, remember the Exxon Valdez scandal, the crash? Yeah, in Alaska, if you're younger, you may not remember it. He worked on that for Exxon. I talked to him about it, and he was really overcome with that. Anyway, one day, we're in a class, and Jim is teaching a lesson on Corinthians. And he says, much like I did, it was a diverse community, a lot of different influences affecting the church congregation there, including genetics and all that kind of stuff we talked about, ethnicity, genetics, and all the other influences that people had at the time. And he, because of his background, he became a Christian from these influences in camp and elsewhere along his life's journey, along his path through the labyrinth, that caused him to come to this conclusion. He says, well, I believe that Baptists, Methodists, Episcopalians, even Catholics, sorry, can be saved. Well, and he said, I believe that Billy Graham is my brother. Well, silence. One lady stands up. She says, well, she's really quite furious. I don't know how you can believe Billy Graham is your brother. He doesn't believe anything like we do. And I really am upset that you believe that he's your brother. Well, did Fred stand up and defend Jim? Nope. What I wish I would have said was, you know, I don't know if I think that Billy Graham is my brother. I mean, I really hadn't thought about it that much. But I love Jim. And Jim is my brother. And if he believes that for the sake of unity, I'm going to let him believe it. I wish I had said that. I was young and gutless at the time. Anyway, Jim stopped teaching his class, left the church along with his family, eventually retired to Louisiana, Texas, where he died about a year ago. When Connie and I first moved it, he married a gal named George. I don't know why her name was George. Her name was George. And they invited us over for dinner after church. We were there. We had just gotten married. This is a long time ago. And invited us, hey, we're having some people over for lunch after church. Why don't you come? Jim cooked shrimp tempura. Oh, man. It was wonderful. Anyway, we got to know them, and they were wonderful, wonderful people. But Jim died about a year ago. I think he had dementia or something like that. Anyway, our labyrinth, we're all in this labyrinth path, kids. There is no direct route to the center. None. You have to go around. You're going to be, the path is indicated by a red thread. Remember what I said about Ariadne had the red thread to help him get in and out of the labyrinth? We're guided by the red thread, which in our case is the blood of Jesus, which, by the way, Jesus shed for everyone. Much like the Church of Colossae, our Christian path is routed by multiple influences that there may be some commonalities. Some of those examples I gave, some of those, especially the white middle-aged man who went to college and, hello. Am I still middle-aged? Can I still call myself middle-aged or not? No, I can't. There's going to be different. We're going to be different, folks. We are. We're going to run into thousands of people, maybe millions during our journey, who in turn are on their own Christian journeys through their own labyrinth to kill the Minotaur and put on Christ. So we're committed to unity. So that's part of our mission. Is it a mission or vision statement? I don't even know. It's one of those. Guess what? The committed to unity is about in the very center of our mission statement. Go read it. It's like right in the center. It's like almost everything else in the mission statement spins around that. That the binding power of agape love. Garments worn daily. Just as a ligament holds the body together, love is the ultimate glue that unites virtues like compassion, patience, forgiveness into a mature, harmonious community. No labels other than being clothed in Christ. So I'm going to give you a couple examples. I'm grateful for Jim Takamoto, who's an influence in my journey through the labyrinth, for helping me to sort of understand that the kingdom of Christ goes beyond these four walls. I'm glad for Jim. This Jim, wave your hand so we know who you are. Jim has said on more than one occasion, we're going to be surprised by who we meet in heaven. I'm not misquoting you there, am I? No. Okay. I'm grateful for Alan Cardinal, who, by the way, is teaching a fabulous class on the history of the church, how we got to where we are. All these sects and people that were trying to do the best they could, really, to follow what they believed to be Christ's revelation. Now, we would disagree with a lot of that. A lot of that would be salvation issues, probably. A lot of it influenced how we got here. By the way, if you're not in that class, you're missing out. And also, Jason here is adding a lot of contributions based on his historical knowledge of the situation. I'm grateful for you and your Catholic upbringing, by the way, which brings a perspective to Mary, to how we view ourselves as Christians. I'm grateful for Vicki Phillips, who works with other Christian groups in this community to serve Christ through the food bank and other activities. Who else have I got in here? Ed Martin, are you here? Okay, I'm grateful for Ed Martin. Ed served in Vietnam. He could tell you stories that will curl your hair. Yet Ed remains faithful. He somehow saw God. He didn't get rid of God because of what he saw being godless in Vietnam. So thank you, for Ed, for that, for your ability to add to our value here. See, who else have I got in here? I'm grateful for this church. This congregation contributed to Connie's mission to Dominican Republic, even though it was outside the boundaries of our four walls. It's a Christian group based in Saginaw, a church based in Saginaw. Thank you for that, whoever helped make that happen. And people were blessed because of that. Okay. Anyway, I invite all of you at the end of the service to go out and look at our photo wall of our membership out there in the back. Take a look. All of those people, all of us, have been shaped differently. We believe different things. We identify ourselves in the world through a bunch of labels. In here, those labels go away, folks. Go away. There's no labels other than being clothed. Look at those things and say, how did they get here? I'll bet you there are stories that people could tell. Oh, by the way, I want to say thank you to Suzanne Fuson. Suzanne is here. They were, for those of you who don't know, she and Scott, who's not here, Scott. I don't know. So, and a couple of kids, one or two grandkids. I lost count. Anyway, Suzanne, let's see. So we've known each. Let's see. I'm 45, and you're about we've known each other for a while. We've known each other for 55 years, something like that. Okay. Anyway. I don't know what it is. As you walked in, I said, I have to think about this. I'm grateful for whatever influence you had on my life 50 years ago, 40 years ago. I don't know what that is. I'm sure it was something. Okay. I'm grateful for Darren. Darren, who I was almost going to say, I let beat me in golf the other day, but I knew Darren at Allen Park when I was going to church there. I didn't even. That was 45 years ago. I don't know what influence he had on me then, but I'm sure he did. Thank you for that. Okay. Anyway, we need to appreciate each other's differences. Okay, this is where Star Trek comes in. So, Star Trek, first three these wacky, like, whatever, Deep Space Nine, all that stuff. So, season three. So, his name is Surak. Not Mr. Spock, no. Surak is this guy's name. He's considered to be the father of Vulcan logic. Okay. He may have been in one or two episodes, I don't know. Anyway, he said, I am pleased, thrilled, excited, honored that we have this. May we together. He's talking about Vulcans and humans, by the way. Different labels. May we together become greater than the sum of both of us. Those of you who have spent life in a corporate environment know the term synergy. 1 + 1 = 3. Okay, that's kind of trite. Is it trite? Is that a trite thing now, Bill? No. Together we can do more than we can as individuals, folks. That's what I'm saying. So, I don't know, did I go too long? Sorry, Mom, she's not here. We're all journeying through this labyrinth. Doesn't end until the day we pay our undertaker with the last dime. Pay the undertaker with the last dime. I encourage us all to strive to put to death those things that keep us from being unified. and to strive to put the things on, to clothe ourselves with those things that bind us together. Okay? And with that, I think we can stand and sing.